organizers for having invited me to this excellent workshop. Let me write the title. This is joint work with Alex Tosbis and Xin Zhou. Let me first make an outline of the talk. I first would like to talk about the linear problem. In fact, before I do that, let me define the problem exactly. So what we're talking about is I epsilon q sub t plus epsilon squared qxx plus mod q squared q is equal to zero. Initial data are going to be q of x and 0 is set of x, and let me correct myself, q of x and 0 equals a of x e to the I s of x over epsilon, where a of x is a set, and s prime of x is minus mu hyperbolic tangent of x. So this is our a, and this, if this is x, and this is the derivative of the phase. A similar problem that corresponds actually exactly to our situation, mu equals zero, was considered by Canvisis, McLaughlin, and Miller. This is Ken McLaughlin. And they obtained several results. If I were to state it as a theorem, the assumption would be if a certain construction can be made, if a certain curve can close, then we can obtain these results. And essentially, what we're doing here, in again a slightly different case, because we will not be speaking about mu greater than zero, is we carry out this construction, and the asymptotic behavior is proved rigorously. The result we are looking for is to find the, to write a formula, an explicit formula, goes like q asymptotic of xt and epsilon, as epsilon goes to zero, where this is given by formula. And then on top of this, we're talking about long time, we want to take also, so after epsilon goes to zero, we want to take t going to zero and see how this formula becomes. Thank you. We want to take t going to infinity and see how this formula becomes. And since the final formula does contain epsilon, there is a fast oscillation that's driven by epsilon, we have to give the domain, you know, the epsilon t domain in which these results would apply, and this domain, I will give it in the end. So this is the setup of the problem. Now, to begin with, I will consider the linear problem. And I want to put a certain spin and make certain comparison between linear and nonlinear. So what I'll try to do, and I'll try to do it as quickly as possible, is to actually do the linear, solve the linear problem completely, and come out with a formula. So, of course, this is like a first-year graduate course, but please excuse me for that. In the linear case, the equation is this. Then, in the linear world, everything, the building block of all solutions are plane waves. Plane waves, let me write it. I'm writing these things because I want to carry out analogies. So plane waves are things like this, where A is constant, and S is like kx minus omega t plus delta. And if we look at the real or imaginary part, or if we look at the amplitude or phase and do contour lines on the xt plane, what we're going to see is something like that. And that's where the name plane waves comes from. Now, one step above this, there's the so-called modulated plane wave. And the modulated plane wave is something that looks like this. And, of course, again, if I look at level curves for real or imaginary part of this, or for the actually no amplitude or phase, I'm going to see, let me stay with the phase. If I look in the phase, the level lines are going to be like this. Of course, if I focus at a certain point and sort of blow it up, it's going to be, you know, all functions are linear close to a point. So again, it's like a plane wave. And why have I mentioned this? Because in the end, we have that the answer to the problem here, Q, can be described, when epsilon is small, can be described in terms of modulated plane waves in the following way. So to solve the problem, I would apply Fourier transform. So Qx of t is going to be, I start with my initial condition. The initial condition is A of y, let's say e to the I s of y over epsilon. I will take the Fourier transform minus I z over epsilon y. My Fourier variable is going to be z over epsilon. I'm just scaling the Fourier variable. Then I'll multiply by the Fourier propagator e in the exponent. It's minus I z squared t over epsilon. I will take the inverse Fourier transform plus I x z over epsilon. And of course, all this needs to be integrated dy dz over epsilon. I can bring the epsilon to the very front, where there's also a 2 pi. I have the two integrals, and this is the answer. Now, how do we find out what happens? How do we do this thing? How do we go to a particular point at xt to find out how the solution looks like? We do steepest descent, in this case, stationary phase. So, steepest descent in the particular case, it's stationary phase, which says that we must look at the critical points of the exponent. We'll do that. I have to take the derivative with respect to y. That gives me s sub y minus z equals 0. Take derivatives with respect to z. This will give me a minus y minus z. Let me say minus z, because in my original equation, I'd like to put a 2 here. So I would have a 2 there. So it will give me a minus ZT plus X is equal to 0. And by doing some trivial operation, you can see the Z is a spectral variable, right? So by doing a trivial operation, you'll see that Z sub T plus Z Z sub X is equal to 0. So Z satisfies the Burgers equation, which is known as the iconal equation here. Why iconal? In Greek, icon, well, everybody understands what icon means. It means picture in Greek. It shows you a picture like these lines up there. It shows you how the line goes. So this is Burgers' equation. Okay, how? What kind of initial data do I have? Well, my face, Z, is equal to S sub Y. So it's the derivative of the face. I started with a derivative of the face that looks like this. So this is my initial data for Burgers. There's my initial data for Burgers. Of course, this is the X or the Y line. And now I have to let this go. When I let this go, we all know that I go to a form like this. I let the time be somewhat long. So after all, I'm fishing for all long time things. This is what Burgers will do. And here is where I will be. So if I want to go at a particular point X and look at the solutions at the time T where I've come to this curve, my solutions are going to be here, here, and there. And this is the Z axis. So this is what the Z's are going to be. Okay, now I found these points. Of course, it is also clear that before there is a break, I will only have one solution. And therefore, if I plot the number of solutions in an XT plane, I will find that there is a point, a certain time, where I have a break. There will be these two lines. Over here, I'll be having one solution. Over there, I will be having three solutions. And these lines are the well-known caustics in space-time. There's a phase transition between the two. Now, how will the solution look like? Well, according to the steepest descent, the main contribution is coming from the stationary points. There are, let's say, three stationary points. This is just X, it has nothing to do. And therefore, I can write, after a little bit of algebra, I can write, no, not algebra, just thinking, I can write the answer as Q of XT is equal to the sum over J. J runs over the stationary points. A of Z sub J over A of Z sub J T plus B of Z sub J. Actually, in this case, it does not depend on Z sub J, to the 1/2, and this is absolute value, times E to the S tilde of Z sub J over epsilon minus I Z squared T over epsilon plus I Z X over epsilon. These Z's are Z J's. So essentially what I have is I found that I have a sum of modulated plane waves. If I go, therefore, if I have a window in here, I'm going to see, at a small window, I'm going to see three plane waves coexisting. So it will be a much more unstructured thing to see than over here. Now, what about long times? Because after all, we're studying long time. Well, remember, this curve is traveling at a certain speed, what is this point here? That point there is the speed up here is z, therefore it is mu, because mu is the highest point over there. So this point roughly is mu t. And where is that point coming from? It's coming from back here, if you go back mu t, and that point here is coming from there, going back mu t. So if under this graph I plot the amplitude function, namely the a, I find out that two of the points are having extremely low amplitudes, while the third point coming from here has this amplitude. And therefore, out of these three things in here, for a long time, I'll be left with one plane wave, modulated plane wave, and I'm going to have a t to the 1/2 in the denominator. So one good question is, now I was speaking to a wise person and asked the question, what's the difference between, what's the definition of an integrable system? What is an integrable system? And this wise person said to me, an integrable system is a system where you can do everything. So I think this is actually a better definition than most I've heard. So how much of this can one do in the nonlinear case? And that is the issue. So in the nonlinear case, I started with plane waves. Are there nonlinear plane waves? When I say nonlinear here, I'm talking integrable nonlinear. So are there nonlinear waves? Are there plane waves? Sure they are. Abundant. What are they made of? Well, they're not made of exponentials. Exponentials do participate in the formula, but the main ingredient is the Riemann theta function, which involves elliptic integrals or hyperelliptic integrals. And so although the plane wave itself is not just equal to the theta function, you use a few theta functions to build that plane wave. And the theta function, if it's hyperelliptic, it has several slots. And the waves in there, they're coming from elliptic functions. Elliptic functions mean what? They involve a square root. So you have an R of Z, which is equal to Z minus alpha 0 times Z minus alpha 0 bar times Z minus alpha N. Actually, I will go 2N. I'll be skipping the odd numbers. Z minus alpha 2N bar square root. There is a construct like this, is a square root that brings in a Riemann surface, and the theta functions are made out or related to this Riemann surface, and you get a certain number of slots in the theta function, and the theta functions we'll end up with having are going to look like this. I will skip the plane waves to save some time, and I'll go to the modulated waves. How do the modulated waves look like? They look like theta of W1 of vector alpha, alpha meaning all of these things, over epsilon plus U1 of vector alpha, comma W2 of vector alpha over epsilon plus U2 of vector alpha, etc. So what's the difference between modulated and unmodulated wave here? Unmodulated wave, the alpha is really, it's dependence on x and t. It's pretty much like the s up there. It's just linear in x and t. Otherwise, in the modulated case, you have the alpha to be equal to alpha of x and t. And you observe that there are no free accentees. You know the alphas, you know everything. When you do in the end write the formula for the plane wave, you may need some exponential accent t explicitly, pretty much as you see the accent t explicitly in the linear case, but it appears there in a sort of, you know, simple way. So the truth of the matter is there are plane waves in the nonlinear world, and you can modulate them. And what are modulation equations in the linear? Yes. What is being modulated here? I was coming later to this. Thank you very much. Suppose I were to put here, one would expect that the period of this, or the wave number, rather, in x would be something like w1 sub x in this slot. That's not exactly the case, because the theta matrix, the Riemann surface itself gives you a certain periodicity. The theta function has its own periodicity in these slots. Everything, however, including that periodicity, is built into the alphas. So if I change the alphas, I really know everything about that theta function. So you do have the plane waves, you can modulate them. And the answer is this. The question is this. True or false that if you look at the window, you start with nonlinear NLS, focusing NLS, you look into an XT window that is of scale larger than epsilon, but less than one. True or false that in there you're going to see really a finite number of plane waves? Now, a finite number of plane waves means represented by a theta function that has as many slots as the waves we're talking about, because in the linear world, plane waves are added. In the nonlinear world, the theta function is the nonlinear Fourier tool. It really mixes, it really puts various modes together in the correct nonlinear way. So when you're saying that you do a Fourier transform of something, the theta representation of something would be something in terms of a hyperelliptic theta function in using a certain number of waves. Okay, so there will be the theory also would produce, the linear theory produces this equation. This equation could be called the modulation equation, because everything here, wave numbers and so on, frequencies, are governed by what the z's are doing. And the z is coming from this. Of course, the amplitudes are not. And as you know, in the linear theory, there's another equation following this, namely the amplitude equation hierarchy. And, you know, the leading amplitude equation would be the second modulation equation. What would be modulation equations here? In here, it would be sum equation of this form, where F has several components, enough components, so that you can calculate all the alphas. And this, in the theory, we will be able to find something like this that will allow us to make the correct representation in terms of plane waves. Now, there is the approach of modulation theory in linear theory, which starts with an ansatz. The ansatz in linear theory would be, let us assume that the answer is a plane, modulated plane wave, and drive on. One can get lots of things, but in the end, one can't really, it's very hard to get rigorous results this way, because you're also, you're followed by your ansatz. Same here. We could say, I'm going to use these as my building blocks and come up with an ansatz. So this is an ansatz and pull it through. And there is a big literature on this. I don't want to go there because I would have to spend too much time. There's a lot of important work done there. What is being done here is different. It's the equivalent to doing the steepest descent, where you find these Z's come up naturally. You don't plant them there. And we're going to do a steepest descent here in the corresponding nonlinear world. So what is the corresponding object to this integral? I've had the benefit to have two very good talks before me, Shinzo and Percy Dave, who really gave you a flavor of what this is. And this is the inverse scattering. So let me say something very quickly, something general very quickly, and then I'll go to the more detail. How do you do NLS through inverse scattering? There is the Zakharov-Shabbat equation, I epsilon dx c equals z minus z q bar c, and this is one equation for this field C. You should think of this C as being a 2x2 matrix. So I think of it as a fundamental solution for that problem. And there's a time evolution, I epsilon dt C equals something similar. The only thing that's different, you get some Q sub X's in there. And those two things, you can think of them as really being the Lax pair. Here you have an evolution in X, which goes completely independent of T. T is a parameter. Here you have an evolution in T, goes independently of X. Therefore, there's a compatibility condition. And if you apply this here, you end up with actually both ways focusing NLS. So NLS is the compatibility condition for this, and therefore that's what you mean by linearizing. You go back and work here instead of working there. Now, as you have heard, there is the scattering transform. And what the scattering transform does is it takes you from the Q of X, and let's forget time for a moment, it takes to some, I'll call it R0 of Z. Now observe that here we already have some spectral parameter. I mean, it's not exactly what we have over in the linear case, but plays exactly the same role. So we go from something in the real world to something in the spectral parameter, and we also have solitons. I will say something about solitons in the very end. Some of our results, not the long time. The long time results of the solitons is something we're working on now, and it's very interesting because there's a possibility of many, many breaks one after the other. So we have global results in time for no solitons for pure radiation, and some results when there are also solitons. So you go from QX to R0 of Z, and I'm forgetting solitons. R0 of Z evolves in a very simple way. R0 of Z at T is R0 of Z at 0 e to the minus I z squared t over epsilon. The reason for this evolution being so trivial is also trivial. When you look what happens in here, what is the reflection coefficient? The reflection coefficient essentially defines the connection between what happens to psi at minus infinity and plus infinity in the x variable. Now, if you go to plus infinity and minus infinity in the x variable, that q is dead, and this equation is as simple as this one. An undergraduate can solve it easily and can tell you what the evolution is, and that's how the evolution comes to be this. And now comes the inverse problem, namely going backwards. So this is the scattering transform. This is the inverse scattering transform. And going backwards is the Riemann-Hilbert problem. Why going backwards is a Riemann-Hilbert problem? Simple again. Let's think it this way. That C is a fundamental matrix solution. How do you define the fundamental matrix solution? You define it by what's happening, what the eigenfunctions are doing at infinity, x going to infinity. Well, there are lots of IZXs in this problem, obviously, and IZX, as Z, as the imaginary part of Z changes sign, you go from blow up to decay. So you have to define things differently in the upper and lower Z half planes. So basically, to make a long story short, you have some C plus, which is the limit of that fundamental solution from above, and some C minus from below. And both limits are fundamental solutions on the real axis, and by what we know from ODE, it must be that these connected by this expression, where C is independent of X. Of course, it depends on Z. Now, as it turns out, the C of Z will be dependent on the reflection coefficient, and you say, why on the reflection coefficient? Well, it should be dependent on whatever was what you used to define the psi's up here and down there. Well, you chose to use behavior at infinity. Well, that's what the reflection coefficient gives, and therefore that C has the reflection coefficient. So you end up with a relation like this. The trouble is that these psi's have lots of oscillations, and their behavior as Z goes to infinity is not that good. So what you want to do is to define a new variable M, which is psi times something like e to the iz x over epsilon e to the minus iz x over epsilon 0, 0. And once you do that, you remove the oscillations, you have behavior of that M going to the identity at infinity, as Percy mentioned earlier. So let me now make a picture of the Riemann-Hilbert problem. I guess I can erase this. After we do some transformation, the Riemann-Hilbert problem ends up being, this is the spectral plane, always a spectral plane. You are looking for this M, and you have, we can orient things this way, and the jump matrix, the problem is M plus equals M minus V. M plus is what you're getting on the left. And the jump matrix over here, there's a certain symmetry upper-lower half plane, so I'll just make the, I'll write things only in the upper half plane. This, the jump matrix over in this region is this, where the R is very simple. It's the R0 of Z multiplied by something e to the iz x over epsilon minus iz squared t of epsilon. So we've got to solve this. Now, and M goes to the identity as V goes to infinity. If you remember from Percy's talk, there was this point Z0 that really was pivotal to everything. You go to that point Z0 and everything was happening around that point. So the question that we want to pose here is, where is that Z0? And is there a point Z0? Well, it turns out that in this case, you don't have really just a point. It's intervals that matter, not points. So we have to work in a certain way to find what is happening. There are going to be some point or points in there that will be important, but it is over intervals where the action is happening. So what we'll do is we'll use the G function mechanism. The whole process that I'm doing here is in the steepest descent method for Riemann-Hilbert problems that was introduced by Percy and by Shin. And in these cases, however, the contribution was coming from a point, and that point came by looking at the linear point. There was also a situation in the Penn-Levesque case where actually you saw an interval, and you know they were able to overcome this. But in problems where you have fully nonlinear waves in the limit, you need something more than that. So you need to introduce some G function and introduce a full mechanism that allows you to find this function. And this was done in the case of KDV, small dispersion KDV, and I participated in that too. So small dispersion KDV ends up with fully nonlinear oscillations in the limit, and this is the problem here, and therefore you need that same mechanism. Now, in this problem, you have some additional, in this problem, in the NLS, the focusing NLS, you have the problem that you have to do excursions, contributing points are outside in the complex plane, and you have to make sure that there are certain curves that close, as you see very shortly. So what happens in here is you go back to the main point of the original steepest descent, which is, remember, Percy having a plus sign. I think the signs were like this, and the Z nod was here, and did different factorizations left and right. The idea in this case is to say, and let me make another picture over here, I'll do the half picture. What we're going to do is we're going to plant points in here. And let me call that point alpha 0, alpha 2, alpha 4. These points will end up being the alphas I was talking about earlier. And then do one factorization in this region, a different factorization over there, same factorization over here, and so on. And the purpose of these factorizations is to allow you to do some contour deformations that will eventually turn the jump matrix into, in this case, a piecewise constant matrix. So, thank you. This is happening at a fixed x and a fixed t. So you go to the point xt, and you do this method in the same way as you calculate the Fourier integral in the linear case at some x and some t. You're integrating over the spectral variable. Now, it was x over 2t because it was the stationary point of the linear problem. Let me. If you do long time in this problem, the only reason you have an xt in the long time problem is because you're looking along rays. In t. No, but in here we're looking at x and t not large. There is no asymptotic, it's the epsilon. So basically there are no rays. When we do long time on top of this, then of course x over t is everywhere. So what is the g function mechanism? The g function, how much time do I have? Okay. The g function mechanism brings in a function. It really eliminates this normalization at infinity. It changes m. It makes a transformation to m from m to some m tilde by multiplying that m by e to the ig plus ig of z over epsilon e to the minus ig of z over epsilon. And what this does, when you bring in this transformation to the jump matrix, it gives you the jump matrix in terms of the expressions g plus, plus g minus, minus f that contains your initial data, and g plus minus g minus. Now, observe, the g and all these points are to be determined. And you determine them in such a way, to determine them, you solve the Riemann-Hilbert problem over some regions. Over in this region, you want g plus, plus g minus, minus f to be some constant. Over here, you want g plus, minus g minus to be some constant to achieve the constants that you need. And you also need a sine structure that turns out to be minus over here, and pluses, I'm sorry, minuses, minuses here, pluses, pluses, minuses over there. So you see the sine structure is different across this kind of arc from that kind of arc. In a way, I'd like to call this a free boundary Riemann-Hilbert problem, because you don't really know where you're changing the type of jump matrix you're requiring. And now, this problem is solvable. It can be reduced, so we can reduce it to a set of equations for the alphas, and also a set of inequalities that's coming from the sine structure. It's the same thing as saying we want the equalities and we want the sine structure, and eventually it is achieved that modulo some error that can be controlled, the original Riemann-Hilbert problem can be written on a contour like this. These are the alphas, alpha 0, alpha 2, alpha 4, and their conjugates. And this can be solved explicitly in terms of the theta functions, which gives you the formulae on the nonlinear plane waves that I mentioned earlier. So they come out, the nonlinear plane waves come out naturally, as in the case of the linear problem. And let me just take a minute to say that in complex variables, you can do lots of things. So in here, you can actually change this contour. You can change the lines, the you can go to this picture, and from this picture, you can associate these intervals with modes, nonlinear modes. So basically, what you have, remember what I started with, in the linear case, you had mu minus mu and x over t. This is the z. This is the spectral axis. These two, you had two z's here, and they were very, very small because you were at the tails of the amplitude. And over here, you had the one that contributed. Over here, instead of these three, you have those three intervals in the nonlinear case instead of points in the linear case. And I, even if I did have time, I wouldn't like to take Alex's punchline when he will do the long time tomorrow. Thank you. The genus comes from the number of points.
Now, but those points can move in x and t. I mean,
these points move in x and t.
The genus actually
in this case, we have recreated this. Well, the picture is not there. In the linear picture, you had the caustics. We get, in the case of pure radiation, we get the nonlinear caustics. Now, however, here there's an angle that's not zero. And in here you have three alphas. Over here you have one alpha. And the way it happens is, and this is really defocusing, is a very unstable kind of thing. This contour that I've been drawing is the imaginary part of some function that's related to G. I could almost say G. It's not G, it's H, but they're very related. So imaginary H equals zero. Imaginary H has another branch here. At some point, this branch touches this. So the point, we have only one point alpha zero. But at some time, or in some XT, these two curves come together. The sign structure is broken, and you are forced. You see, as this comes down here, if you allow the natural topology, you would have to break this way. This is not allowed. It would break the sign structure. So you are forced to do some surgery and add an alpha 2 and an alpha 4. In the case of pure radiation, that's the whole picture. In the case of solitons, and that's a really interesting open problem, we don't know how many more breaks are going to happen. We can prove that that's the only break that can happen in the pure radiation. No restrictions on the, well, in the case of pure radiation, we prove that the genus has to be, you can only have 3 points here. The genus is 2, yeah. The nonlinear Schrödinger, the focusing nonlinear Schrödinger equation is extremely unstable, and actually calculating the initial data is very tricky. So we used, at mu equals zero, there was a paper by Satsuma and Yajima who calculated the spectral data. Then with Alex, we calculated the data for this particular case. If we have analyticity in the initial data, this process will go through. If we don't have analyticity, it's an open question.